So lovely to be here in Ashland with all of you. Master taught method for meditation that he called the mini kriya. It is the method of Hong Sa. And like most meditation techniques, it's entirely simple, but not to be misled because of its simplicity. It's extremely powerful in the ability to help uplift and transform. It is to be transmitted only by those that he authorized. My great guru, Mother Hamilton, was one such, and she gave me authority as well. I want you to begin by watching your breath. As most meditations deal with the breath. A spiritus in the Latin means to breathe. And so spirit and breath and body are intricately connected. As you control your mind and your breath, you enter into a spiritual state of consciousness. So we begin with the breath and simply observing that you are breathing, watching the breath as it passes in through the nostrils, down into the lungs, delivers its load of oxygen, and then reverses with the garbage as it carries out from the venous blood all of the toxins, all of the discharge from your body system. Even and smoothly goes the breath, focusing the mind upon the breath. Begins to bring the mind into a calm state. With the incoming breath, I want you to mentally chant the word Hong, H-O-N-G, Hong. Not trying to control the breath or change it in any way. And as you breathe out, mentally chant the word Sa, S-A-U. On the incoming breath, Hong. On the outgoing breath, Sa. Keep your attention at the point between the eyebrows, what in yoga is called the ajna, or what Master Paramahansa Yogananda denoted as Christ center, Christ consciousness. In India, it is called Kutastha Chaitanya. It is the cosmic consciousness. It is the doorway into the kingdom of heaven. So as you breathe in, mentally chant the word Hong, and as you breathe out, the word Sa. In Sanskrit, this means the I Am, the great I Am consciousness. It is transcendent to the normal self that we identify with in a human sense. It is the transcendent self. It has no beginning and it has no end. Therefore, it has no birth. It has no decay. It has no death. It has always been, it will always be, and it is your eternal heritage. There is nothing that you can do that can destroy it, that can burn it, that can drown it. What your actions do is it creates a wall between you and your awareness of that true self that has ever been and is ever a part of you. It is our spiritual sadhana, it's our spiritual practice that takes down that wall of separation and makes us know who and what we truly are. You will notice that as you continue the chanting of Hong Sa, doing it mentally only, your breath will naturally slow down. It will grow smoother. As you train the mind to focus on those two syllables, Hong Sa, the mind will slow down, and eventually it enters into a state of stillness. You can imagine consciousness as a great body of water. If the breath slows down and comes to a still state, as it can, without any damage to you whatsoever, it is like the wind ceases to blow upon that body of water, and there are no waves. It becomes perfectly mirror-like, reflecting everything that is above it, the mountains, the stars, the moon, the sun. All of that is reflected in the stillness of the mind and the breath. Disturb that body of water, the surface of it, with distracted thoughts, with an uneven breath, and you create waves upon that placid water, and no longer does it reflect what is above, but becomes disturbed. The end goal of all meditation is to produce that still state. As King David said, "Be still and know that I am God." Be still. The stillness of breath, the stillness of mind. Be still. Stillness is not a numb or chloroform state. When you are in stillness, you have never been more alive, more awake. You are fully conscious. It is simply that the things of this earth fade away as your greater reality is revealed. Different sounds, disturbances, the body doing what it does. You just simply let it do what it does. You yourself are that great body of water, undisturbed. By chanting Hong Sa, you are affirming the great I Am, the great Self, with every breath that you take. You can do that wherever, whenever you are. Let us now practice that for a short time. Make this a regular practice, morning and night, and gradually stretch out the time. You can start with a shorter amount of time and then gradually make it longer. I remember when I was still a teen and practicing meditation, and I joined a meditation group. And as a group, we meditated for 1 hour. So I'd sit, and the fellow who led the group had an alarm clock, that the old-fashioned, that had the bells on the top, and the thing would tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. Oh, that hour could be so long sometimes as we sat and meditated. But if you stick with it and learn, teach the mind to go deeper, teach it to go deeper. You know, you see people with little dogs, and sometimes, you know, little Fluffy is running all around, and come here, Fluffy, come here, come here, Fluffy, come here, come here, come here, come here. The more they say it, the more the dog ignores them, happily going out and sniffing all the trees and doing what dogs do. It has no command. It has no purpose behind it. So with the mind, we're not used to disciplining it. We're not used to giving it a purpose. It wanders this way and that. So we sit down to meditate, and it's like Fluffy, running all over, sniffing here, sniffing there, going the speed of light from one thought to another, from one daydream to another. Learn, no, heal, come. Right here. And you get it to heal. You get it to come and obey you. Mind is a tool. It's a wonderful tool for this world. For this world. If you're going to balance your checkbook, you need your mind. Adding, subtracting, you know, all of that. But when it comes to realization and bringing yourself into that still state, mind is a devil. Mind is a monkey. And it jumps all around. So you want to be able to learn to teach the mind. Come. Here. Stay. Hong so. And with practice, you can get the mind to heal, to obey. It doesn't come in a day. Some days are better than other days. That's why we invest every day, morning and night. And then one day, it's like when you exercise and you get used to exercising, and if you miss a day of it, you really miss that exercise. And so you teach the mind to come into that still state. If you miss one meditation, you feel very bad because you miss that feeling of getting into the stillness, getting into the silence. Sometimes you don't realize how far you've ascended up in consciousness until you come back down. And you come back down into world and you think, oh, I was someplace very, very different. That was wonderful. Wonderful. And I wish I was there all the time. The reason is because it feels so natural when you're in that state of stillness. It feels like home. It feels like who and what you truly are. I wanted to read here a bit from Master. He wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita that's very, very wonderful. Bhagavad Gita is one of the oldest scriptures around, very ancient. It is a dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. Arjuna is the warrior. And he represents our third chakra. It's here at the navel. It represents individual willpower. And so Arjuna is known as a warrior. He shoots bows and arrows. It's like exercising our will and determining what we are to do. He finds himself in a tremendous battle, not of his own choosing. Really, he would rather not enter into it, but somebody very evil, a cousin of his, has taken over the kingdom and is not exercising his power correctly, so he needs to be stopped. Arjuna is there to do this, but he gets out, and because of how loyalties go and who is allied with who, on the other side are some of his beloved teachers, family members, others. And he can't imagine going into battle against these people that he knows and that he loves. So he just simply wants to withdraw. This is all symbolic of something that happens inside of us. And sometimes we just want to withdraw from the world. We don't like this world very much. We don't like the direction it's going. We just would rather go to a cave, so we would think. But I don't know if you've ever actually lived in a cave. Caves are not very nice places, by and large. There's only one cave that I've been in, and it's in the south of India. It is where St. Thomas lived, disciple of Jesus, and he had traveled India. It's a beautiful cave. It's perhaps 10, 12 feet high in the center. It drops off on the sides. It's maybe 40 feet across, perfectly dry, beautiful rock, everything. There's a story there that originally there's only one entrance into that cave. And some people came to do harm to Thomas. So what to do? And it said that there is a miracle that happened there. He reached into this granite rock with his fingers, and he pulled that granite rock down, created another opening, and he escaped out of there and got away for the time being. Eventually, he was killed. But for that moment and for that day, he was preserved. And you look at this rock, and it's really quite extraordinary. It's glass-like, where he had reached up, and you could see splines in the rock like fingers that had reached up into it. So it's really quite extraordinary. And I thought when I was in that cave, I thought, this cave I could live in. This is a nice cave. But most caves are not that nice. Cave where Babaji initiated Lari Mahashay and where they had lived. It's quite damp. It's beautiful granite rock all around it. But it's quite damp inside. I imagine if you perhaps had a fire at the mouth of it long enough, it would dry it out, make it a nicer place to be. We think that if we just escape from the world somehow, that life would be easier. We've all had those fantasies at times. So it's not true, of course, because wherever we go, there we are. This self follows, this mind is always going, going, going. So if you can't meditate in your own home where you're relatively comfortable, where can you meditate? This is the time, this is the place. So, as Ramakrishna said, do battle from the fortress. The fortress is the home. So that's the safe place to do battle. That's the safe place to do your sadhana, your spiritual practice. So we all have that imagery of escaping. And Krishna talks to Arjuna and he says, Arjuna, you must fight. You are a warrior. That is what you are born to do. You must preserve what is good. You must preserve what is right. So Master writes on cracking the code of the Gita's yogic symbolism. And it's tremendous, it really is. You begin to understand not just the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, the Holy Bible, all other great scriptures of the world, because they're written on multiple levels. And to really get the full benefit from them, you have to understand the deeper meanings behind these outward symbologies. So Yogananda writes here, the ancient sacred writings do not clearly distinguish history from symbology. Rather, they often intermix the two in the tradition of scriptural revelation. Do you see? They do not clearly distinguish history from symbology. So, for instance, in the story of Jesus, it said that the king at the time, the evil King Herod, he was going to kill all the children of Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, in an attempt to destroy Jesus as well, the incarnation of God who was going to come and take the place of Herod. So in the story of Krishna, you have the same story. It's King Kamsa, and King Kamsa vows to destroy all the children in order that Krishna not be born, because it is foretold that Krishna will take his place as king. It's the same symbology. What's interesting is in the New Testament, it's only written in one of the accounts of Jesus' life that this happened, and that the historian of the time, who talked a lot about King Herod, Josephus, wrote a lot about the things that King Herod did wrong, and he never mentioned this. You'd think that it might rank as one of those things that were really dastardly. So is it history or is symbology? And in these texts, the distinction is not so clear. Not so clear. Prophets would pick up instances of everyday life and events of their times, and from them draw similes to express subtle spiritual truths. Divine profundities would not otherwise be conceivable by the ordinary man unless defined in common terms. If we hear a story, if something tugs at our heartstrings a bit, we're engaged. If it's something that's simply abstract, we don't get it in quite the same way. So storytelling is a wonderful way of doing business. There is a wonderful story about how truth was wandering all over the earth. And wherever it went, any village, any town, any city, truth would announce itself and what the truth is. And people would become very upset, very angry, and pick up truth and throw it right out the door. We don't want you. You're disturbing us. We like our illusions. Please leave. So truth was feeling very sorry for itself as it was wandering from one village to another. And it came upon a being, and that being was filled with rainbows and imagery and beautiful, beautiful. So truth said, "Oh, who are you, you lovely being?" And what this being said is, "I am parable. I am storytelling. And wherever I go, people love me. They love me. They love a good story." Truth felt even worse for itself and said, "Oh my goodness, wherever I go, people don't like me at all. And they throw me away." And parable says, "I just have one problem though. It feels like the inside of me is empty. The core of me is not full. But I feel that you may be that complement that belongs inside of me. Without you, I'm rather empty. I'm entertaining, but I'm not full. I'm not complete." And so from that moment forward, truth and parable joined forces. At the center of parable was truth. And so when parable entered in, people loved the stories. And if they were willing, they would investigate all the way to the center, and there they would find truth. Isn't that a lovely story? So that's how truth and parable started working together. So divine profundities would not otherwise be conceivable by ordinary man unless defined in common terms. When, as they often did, scriptural prophets wrote in more recondite metaphors and allegories, it was to conceal from ignorant, spiritually unprepared minds the deepest revelations of spirit. Thus, in a language of simile, metaphor, and allegory, the Bhagavad Gita was very cleverly written by sage Vyasa by interweaving historical facts and psychological and spiritual truths, presenting a word painting of the tumultuous inner battles that must be waged by both the material and the spiritual man. In the hard shell of symbology, he hid the deepest spiritual meanings to protect them from the devastation of the ignorance of the Dark Ages, toward which civilization was descending, concurrent with the end of Sri Krishna's incarnation on earth. So it is said that Sri Krishna came, you see, in Eastern cosmology, even as with the ancient Greeks and Romans, there is thought to be a cycle of time. As Sri Yukteswar talks about in the Holy Science, there's a 24,000-year cycle. And in that cycle, if we started at the top and go around like a clock, is the Golden Age. And in that Golden Age, there is in a period of enlightenment and harmony, both with spirit and with nature. And then we descend down into further ages, and as we do so, we gradually lose this pure perception on a global level, on a more general level. Individuals can always rise up above what the average man is experiencing. But during the Golden Age, the average person has greater perception of truth and of the higher realities. So as we descend down, we gradually lose that apprehension until we get into the bottom part of the clock, so to speak. And there is the Kali Yuga. And in the Kali Yuga, it's an age of darkness. In this 24,000-year cycle, that age of darkness coincides with what historians call the Dark Ages for us, where there was reading and writing. Hardly anybody knew how to read or write. The Enlightened Ages, from the Greeks, from the Egyptians, from India, and so forth, almost totally vanished. And so we struggled through these Dark Ages, but then we started to gradually come out of them. And as we did so, came the Age of Enlightenment, came the Age of Industrialization. Now, some people may look at that and say, I'm not so sure that's progress. However, in terms of the intelligence of the human being and its ability to apply scientific truth, it was a great stage of advancement. But it's still in the early, early days, so there's a mixture of the darkness from the Kali Yuga that is intermixing with the quickening of intelligence. It's far from complete, and it's far from a golden age. It's many, many thousands of years cosmologically from the golden age. And so Krishna came at a time when we were starting to descend, and these truths have been carried on through the writings and through the repetition. Initially, it was all from memorization. People would memorize long, long texts and be able to recite them verbatim, word for word, all the way. Gradually, we started losing that capacity as we came down into the Dark Ages. And so reading and writing was developed in order to accommodate for what we lacked in memory. It's an interesting idea, isn't it? We think of reading and writing as being, that's more enlightened. Those old people, those people in ancient times, they just sat around the fire and just told stories. We're so enlightened. We have these books where they have these words written down. Or in this case, a tablet that I'm looking at here where the words are there. And you can read those words. That's better than sitting around fires telling stories. Well, how about the Mahabharata, the longest epic poem in the world, far longer than the Iliad. And they memorized every word of it and passed it down from generation to generation, repeating word for word verbatim. We lost that capacity. Therefore, we need books because we don't remember. It's actually an in-between step in which we have accommodated our lack of being able to memorize and attune ourselves to these higher truths by reading and writing. And perhaps one day, reading and writing will be seen as obsolete, when you can just simply hear what somebody has to say and then go back and repeat it word for word. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Thus, in a language of simile and metaphor and allegory, the Bhagavad Gita was very cleverly written by sage Vyasa, interweaving historical facts with psychological and spiritual truths, presenting a word painting of the tumultuous inner battles that must be waged by both the material and spiritual man. Historically, on the brink of such a horrendous war as that related in the Mahabharata, it is most unlikely, as the Gita depicts, Krishna and Arjuna would draw their chariot into the open field between two opposing armies at Kurukshetra and there engage in an extensive discourse on yoga. These two armies ready to clash, ready to go in. Suddenly everything's put on hold. by Krishna and Arjuna have this whole discussion, 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. Not very likely that everybody would put themselves on hold for that. While many of the chief events and persons in the compendious Mahabharata indeed have their basis in historical fact, their poetic presentation in the epic has been arranged and conveniently and meaningfully and wonderfully condensed in the Bhagavad Gita portion. In the primary purpose of setting forth the essence of India's Sanatana Dharma, eternal religion. In interpreting scripture, one must not, therefore, ignore the factual and historical elements in which truth was couched. Think of this applying it to the Bible just as well. You have historical events, but interwoven with all of that are these similes, metaphors, different ways of telling a story, so that you get a higher truth. Now, somebody who's dedicated to historical fact would say, but that's a lie, isn't it? To say that something historically happened, that King Herod killed all of these children? Well, we don't say that stories are necessarily lies. They're stories. What's the intent of the story? The story is to elucidate a higher truth. What is the killing of all the children? When we enter into deepened yogic states of meditation, this life force that is at the base of the spine, that can go out through procreation, is held within the base of the spine. Herod, which represents the passions, wants to expel or cut off the heads of all the children. Instead, that energy is drawn up through the spine. That is Galilee, which means the circuit. And so this Christ consciousness, this Christ seed, gradually rises up through the spine. With each spinal center comes different experiences. And so you have the 12 disciples, because each one of these six centers along the spine has a polarity, has a positive and a negative. So each one is represented by a disciple. And this uprising consciousness encounters these oppositions at each one of these centers. There's a battle that goes on. There's a crucifixion, if you will, that goes on within inside of you. This is a marvelous, marvelous way of telling the story. And as someone said to me one time, well, isn't there an easier way rather than a battle or a crucifixion? Can't you give me a third alternative here? It's just simply describing what we go through as we attempt to rise up, go beyond the old forces of good and evil inside of us, go beyond ignorance into a state of enlightenment. In the story of the Buddha, of Siddhartha Gautama, he is talked about after practicing for 7 years. He finally makes a determination. I'm not going to move from this place, sitting under this Bodhi tree, until I achieve enlightenment. And what happens? All of these opposing forces, these five different daughters of the devil, so to speak, all come to try to tempt him away. And these are the five lower chakras. And they all are competing for his attention. But he is a master yogi, so he sits. He sees them for what they are. He doesn't go after them. He doesn't give in to any of them. He has wars launched towards him. He has all of these things happen, all in the night. Why in the night? You'll notice that many of these events of darkness, when is Jesus taken? In the middle of the night. Night represents darkness, represents ignorance, represents the time when these forces get strong. And so the Buddha battled with all of that, was tempted by it, was made to be afraid of it, if he would be, all as a distraction from his vow to sit until enlightened. He makes it through the night, and what happens? He transcends all of these things. He proves himself to be master of himself. And as a result, he rises up into that high state of nirvana. He goes beyond just simply the human state of consciousness. He remembers who he is. He remembers all of his lifetimes. He sees them all. He understands that he has never been defined by any one of these lifetimes. Which of us, when we're sitting in meditation, suddenly have a memory? And in that memory, we start to daydream. And suddenly we're taken away, as if we're reliving it again. When I was first starting meditation, in my high school years, I had been a wrestler on the wrestling team. And I had gotten an injury in my senior year, but I continued, I was able to wrestle. I did all right, did well when I was wrestling individual matches, but when we went into tournaments, my shoulder would get very, very sore from the injury that I had. And so this one match that was in the state championships, I lost by 1 point. 1 point. So I would be sitting, and it had been a couple of years since all of this had happened. It wasn't that fresh. But you'll see that when you meditate, whatever's hidden in the subconscious mind will come back up. And so suddenly I was re-wrestling that match. I didn't care, really, you know, at that point in my life. But somehow it had gotten purchased inside of me. And so I just would be wrestling that match, and suddenly I'd be sitting on my woolen blanket, I'd be sitting in the half lotus position, and I'd be leaning over, and I'd be just so tense in my whole body as I was re-wrestling that match. And then I'd come to, and I think, what am I doing? I'm sitting here meditating, and instead, I'm just all tensed up. Whatever it is that calls to us, whatever it is that's unresolved in the unconscious mind, will come to us. Even things that we're not aware of. I would say in general sense that I'm not a fearful person. I never was. But suddenly some great fear would come up over me as I sat meditating. And as I faced that fear, I just wanted to be anywhere other than sitting on my meditation blanket. And that is why keeping a regular pattern of meditation is so important, because it would be very, very easy at that point. I'm bored. I'm afraid. I'm whatever. Fill in the blank. And it comes up so strong while you're meditating. There was a time when I was meditating, my right knee would get so painful. So painful. And then I'd think about getting up. Well, I just can't sit here anymore. The moment I thought about getting up, the pain went away completely. Hmm. How does that happen? It's not a physical pain. It's something that's getting generated inside of me. Doesn't mean that you can't stick your leg out for a little while if you're sitting cross-legged and relieve yourself a bit. But recognize how these oppositional forces come up inside of you. The Bhagavad Gita, the Bible, the other great scriptures of the world, they're all describing in symbolic, picturesque ways. They're giving you these wonderful stories to tell you about yourself, to tell you about yourself, to tell you about your own struggle, to tell you about your own victories. Everything is contained within these scriptures. And if you read them with that idea, you'll begin to glean some of the ideas, some of the ways for you to overcome. One has to know, Master continues, how to recognize the signs of the convergence of material illustrations with spiritual doctrines without trying to drag a hidden meaning out of everything. One must know how to intuit the cues and express declarations of the author, and never fetch out meanings not intended, misled by enthusiasm and the imaginative habit of trying to squeeze spiritual significance from every word or statement. The true way to understand Scripture is through intuition, attuning oneself to the inner realization of truth. Through the help of a God-realized guru, one learns how to use the nutcracker of intuitive perception to crack open the hard shell of language and ambiguity to get at the kernels of truth in scriptural sayings. My guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, never permitted me to read with mere theoretical interest any stanza of the Bhagavad Gita or the aphorisms of Patanjali, India's greatest exponent of yoga. Master made me meditate on the scriptural truths until I became one with them. Then he would discuss them with me. In this way, during those precious years in the blessed company of my master, he gave me the key to unlock the mystery of the scripture. Master described how they would, Sri Yukteswar would say, all right, we're going to focus on this one verse, maybe just one line, one sentence, and we're going to meditate on it. And they would meditate for an hour. And then, all right, we're going to meditate for another hour on that. Days, weeks would go by, the same line, the same verse. And every once in a while he would ask Yogananda, what do you glean from this? What do you understand? And they would keep on that same passage until Sri Yukteswar was satisfied that he had penetrated into the core of that one sentence, of that one saying, of that one story. Because it wasn't just an intellectual exercise. We can read so many books. We can memorize things. We can use the intellect to understand so much, but it does us no spiritual good at all in the end until we intuit the true, deeper meaning that's inside. And it isn't just any thing that just pops to your mind. We have to be disciplined. We have to be spiritual scientists. We have to understand that to get the real meaning out of this is to go deeper until it resonates with every cell of our being. When you get a true intuition from divine consciousness, your entire being is enlightened. It's not just an idea that pops into your mind. You are illumined. You understand, and not just with the mind, but with every cell of your being, it resonates to this truth. It's a deep, deep sense of knowing. It is said in the Bible that we need to test every spirit, and this is absolutely true. Not everything that comes to us, even in meditation. Sometimes things come as a test. Sometimes they come as a distraction. Sometimes it's Mara, the devil, who tests the Buddha, who's come to us to see if it can distract us, to go deeper and deeper and deeper until we feel that we are on solid foundation. This is what Sri Yukteswar had Yogananda do. And they went about halfway through the Gita. And Master, every once in a while, he said, can we move on now? I'm tired of this. I've read this. I understand it. But he didn't, you see. He understood it with the mind, but he hadn't gone deep enough, far enough. And Sri Yukteswar would keep at him. And they got about halfway through doing this with the Bhagavad Gita. And then Sri Yukteswar said, all right, now you know the key. Now you can read any of these scriptures. And you can intuit the deeper meaning of them. Isn't that wonderful? Why? Because he had developed that faculty inside of him that understood on that deeper level. Without that, you can read all of the interpretations, you can read all of the scriptures, and you will never truly understand them. It'll only be on the surface. It is only by going deeper and developing that understanding that you will be able to truly recognize the deep power that has sustained these scriptures for thousands of years. How is it that people have gotten inspired from this? You know, if we go to rewatch a television show or a movie that was, oh, I've seen that. You know, I've seen that. I don't need to see it again. How quick we are to move on to the next thing. How difficult it is to slow the mind down, to go deeper until we understand the broad meaning of this, what it's inspired people for thousands and thousands of years. It is said that the Gita is perhaps 5,000 years B.C., 7,000 years old. And still it is chanted, still it is repeated, still it is meditated upon. And does it have something to offer us? I think it does. I think it does, as much as any sacred scripture does. So, when we are dedicating ourselves to this, we are entering into spiritual combat. Now, it's not always combat, is it? Some days are better than other days. Some days you get up and you just feel enlightened and think, shouldn't it always be like this? Won't it always be like this? And then suddenly there's a telephone call, somebody cuts us off in traffic, we read some news in the newspaper, and our minds are drawn right back into this world. We lose everything that we've had. That's the battlefield. We've entered into it. That's the oppositional force. And it is not, of course, that you can't read the newspaper or take a drive someplace. Of course not. That would be a prison of a different kind. But to be able to do so and to maintain your equanimity, to maintain that connection with your deepest spiritual self at all times and in all places, and to do that, we have this true dedication. I'd like to read a little bit more from Ramakrishna. He's one of India's great spiritual masters. And the gospel of Ramakrishna is really that. It really is a gospel. But Ramakrishna is here talking about really carrying full intention and purpose into your spiritual practice. And he's saying there are women who come to the Ganges for their bath. Now in India, if you go to the Ganges, it said if you take a dip there, that it can purify your whole being. It's an interesting notion, isn't it? Can you get benefit by taking a bath in the river? And I can only tell you this, my own experience of it. When I was in India, I was in an ashram up near Babaji's cave, where Babaji initiated Larhi Mahasaya. I was sitting in meditation at this ashram, and somebody was doing some tantric exercises, breathing exercises next to me. And I could tell it was not a good intention. He was doing it to gain powers. And there was a darkness around him. There is an ashram dog, and the ashram dog and I got along quite well. When Carl and I would go to a particular lookout place in the morning and meditate, the dog always came with us and sat for the whole time for meditation. He's a wonderful dog, wonderful dog. I could feel this darkness from this fellow next to me, and when we got up and left there, it was nighttime, the dog started barking at me. He'd never barked at me before. He'd always just wagged his tail and followed along. He started barking at me. I could feel that there was this darkness around me and that the dog was reacting to this darkness. Eventually, we left that place. We went down and were staying next to the Ganges down below. And so as I was there, we were taking a dip in one of the rivers. There's a beautiful ashram there called Pulchati, means places of the roses, many roses, and they grew a lot of roses. It's right next to Ganges. It was a wonderful ashram that was there. And there's a little streamlet that fed into the Ganges there, and used to go in and bathe there because, frankly, the water was a little warmer than it was in the Ganges. The Ganges was just coming out of the mountains. It was quite cold, and I wasn't sure how to get into the Ganges. There was a large flowing river there. And so I took it there, took the bath there, and that was nice, but I really wanted to get into the Ganges. So I found a place where we could get down and get into it. It's very deep mud there. Went down, it was very cold, but took a dip in, and when I came out, both of us experience the difference. The difference between that stream flowing into the Ganges and the Ganges itself. And somehow the Ganges itself, because I was still carrying that darkness, it took it away. It took it away. Now, if you told me before that the Ganges had special qualities, okay, I had heard that. But I'm not sure that I gave it much thought until that moment. And then I knew this is a special place. This is a special river. So that's why people go down to the Ganges. So Ramakrishna says, there are women who come to the Ganges for their bath, and instead of thinking of God, gossip about no end of things. What jewels did you offer at the time of your son's marriage? Has so-and-so returned from her father-in-law's house? So-and-so is seriously ill. So-and-so went to see the bride. We hope that they will offer a magnificent dowry and that there will be a great feast. Harish always nags at me. He can't stay away from me even an hour. My child, I couldn't come to see you all these days. I was so busy with the betrothal of so-and-so's daughter. You see, they have come to bathe in the holy river, and yet they indulge in all sorts of worldly talk. The master began to look intently at younger Naren and went into samadhi. Did he see God himself in the pure-souled devotee? The devotee silently watched the figure of Sri Ramakrishna motionless in samadhi. A few minutes before, there had been so much laughter in the room. Now there was deep silence, as if no one were there. The master sat with folded hands, as in his photograph. So when we enter into our spiritual practice, let us be sure we're not like the mothers who came down to the Ganges. Mind is all out there, you know. Who said what? Who did what? What happened yesterday? What disturbs me? Let us enter as if we are entering into an ancient sacred temple, feeling the power and the vibration of that place. If you meditate in one chair, one woolen blanket, it is said that wool helps insulate us from the vibrations from the earth. And you enter into your meditation and you bring with you your all. This is a sacred time, entering into your temple of silence. And as you do so, you will train this mind. It will no longer be Fluffy the dog that goes here and there. It will come. It will heal. It will grow in quietness. And the great body of water that is your consciousness will become completely mirror-like and still. And it will begin to reflect the mountains above you. The mountains are the uplifted consciousness. It will reflect the stars. The stars are the stars of your own spine. And you will see the lights within your own spine and your cranium. You will see the moon reflected in the water. And the moon is your solar plexus. And this is the place where intuition comes from the world. You meet somebody, you walk into a room, you like it, you don't like it, it registers here at the solar plexus. You will see the sun. The sun is seen here at the point between the eyebrows at the ajna. And it is the great light of divine consciousness. All of these things will naturally be reflected in the still mind and open up to you a much greater awareness than you could have ever known, just simply but through the use of the mind and of the senses. They are not capable, the mind nor the senses, of being able to enter into that still state. And so it is said in the scriptures, no man has seen God. And what that means is no one in a human state of consciousness can perceive divinity and the pure consciousness It is only when the humanness in us becomes completely still or as dead that divine consciousness can fully reveal itself. Very happy that you have come here tonight and that we can talk about these things. For me, this is the most important subject in the world. And to spend this time and attune ourselves to something higher and something greater, and then to go on to dedicate our lives in that manner, promises something tremendous. But it takes dedication, it takes doing the work, it takes going through the good times and the bad. It is like a marriage in that sense. We have to weather every condition that the mind throws at us. But remember, whatever the mind throws at you, it would have no emotional charge for you if it didn't somehow relate to your own past. And so whatever it is that comes up, you created it at some point in your existence. And this is the time and this is the place for you to be able to change that pattern, to let go of that emotional charge, and to become which you really are, what you really are. And that is the divine self within you. Now let us take a few moments, residing in the silence. Focused on the Hong Sa. If and when your breath comes into a complete state of stillness, then just reside in that stillness. It will not harm you. If your body needs a breath, it will take one. You'll chant Om with me 3 times. Sacred light within you.